The Knife Thrower by Subterrane. The convoy drives through the night more often than not, and they pull into Kearney, Nebraska around 9 a.m. on a dark Friday in September. The site is just a big muddy field with a few hairs of grass poking here and elsewhere, and the rain coming down like little splinters of an early winter. Dean twitches at the curtain as their trailer pulls up in a jagged formation with the others, and curses whatever dinky-ass town council thought it'd be a good idea to have a couple dozen 60-ton semis and 10-ton flatbeds pulling up on a glorified soccer field. "They couldn't have cleared out a frickin' parking lot," he growls out the window. Sam eyes the clouds and the puddles and says, "The rides are all going to be axle-deep in mud by Sunday." Still, they stump down out into the wet, Dean shrugging on a flannel-lined canvas jacket he pulled out from a deep cabinet, and Sam folding a knit cap over his head, shuddering briefly against the chill. Already there's a crew pulling back panels on the main rig, unstrapping poles and the giant folds of dirty plastic that'll make up the sideshow tents. They slog through ankle-deep mud to take up their share of plywood flooring, Sam muttering about low crowd turnouts in this weather at the ass end of the season. 5 hours into setup, Cooper shows up with a couple of guys in clean Gore-Tex jackets, locals, obviously, all looking a little foul around the mouths. The tents are up, the rides are mostly unfolded, and every man standing is wet to the bone and splattered in mud that smells awfully well fertilized. Cooper waves an arm and shouts with the sliding edge in his ringmaster's voice, "All right, everyone, let's pack it up. The illustrious mayor of Kearney here says we ain't welcome in this here shithole." There's a dense silence, and Dean slides a look at Sam from across the 6-foot length of riser they're carrying. It's damn heavy. Sam crouches to put his end down, and Dean does the same. "What the hell you mean, ain't welcome? We got a signed contract," shouts someone. Dean sees that it's Carl, the knife thrower, and the only guy other than Cooper who's been around longer than him and Sam. "Contract doesn't cover the serial killer you got riding around with you," says the balder of the two locals. "We don't need any of that here." Sam expels a hiss of breath and looks just about as offended as the rest of the crew. All of them large men standing around half frozen and faced with the prospect of undoing half a day's labor for free. Mayor Gore-Tex is an awfully ballsy man, telling 3 dozen roustabouts and carnies to their faces that one of them's a child-touching murderer. If he realizes it, though, he doesn't much show it. He stands with his feet planted, and Cooper looks around a little wildly, like maybe he's hoping someone will step up and cow the man. But nothing. For a second, Dean thinks that Sam will take the hint and sock someone in the mouth, but it passes. It's an easy leap to say they don't have a lot of options. With another look, Dean and Sam bend to shoulder their riser again and start back toward the truck it came off of. Pretty soon, everyone's doing the same. Everything's back on the trucks at 6, and thank God all but one of them, the rig carrying the 30-ton turbo drop, gets out of the mud okay. They put down some plywood, which splinters all to hell, but eventually they roll the truck out, and everyone loads back up onto the trailers. As 20 engines roll over, Cooper mutters over the radio that they'll overnight at North Platte, 100 miles down the road. "Not gonna be any better in North Platte," says Sam, stripping off wet layers. There's a red mark on his forehead from the hat. His hair is a pressed and greasy tangle. Dean sits on the bed they never bother turning back into a table and puts his sock feet up against the green cushion opposite. He watches Sam peel out of flannel and wool and cotton, down to damp skin. Sam continues, "Cooper should skip this end of the circuit, head straight down south for the winter. No one's heard about this shit down there." Dean doesn't answer. He kind of suspects they probably have. 3 families, 6 murders, 3 states, Medford, Fergus Falls, Groton. The police caught on to the link pretty quick. The entire convoy's been searched 4 times now. Local sheriffs and the feds once too. But now it's just out-and-out rejection when they show up, chased out of town like gypsies. "You gonna ask Carl if you can do the knives next show?" Dean asks instead. Outside, through the fog on the plastic windows, he can see the lights of Kearney, a town full of bedrooms and breathing parents. The trailer rolls along steady. The contortionists who live on the other side of the curtain up front are too delicate for cold or heavy lifting, but at least they do most of the driving. Sam shrugs and plugs in the kettle, dumps powdered cocoa in mugs. "He doesn't like it much when I do. Liked it better when I was 8 years old, standing still, so he could split apples." "Just worried you're better than him," Dean yawns and stretches. Now the engine's running and the air's warming up, smelling like diesel and mold. They don't clean much. Sometimes Leonora pokes her head back and complains, or just does it for them. You are. And you don't need to fake blind to prove it, either. I could do it blind, says Sam, a tinge in his voice. He could, probably. But Carl's still got seniority. Dean does the Houdini thing the night Sam's allowed to play the big tent throwing knives. He does handcuffs, knots, straitjackets. Nothing truly challenging, because everything's got to be mobile. And when Carl does the knife throwing, Dean and Sam do the psychic thing in the sideshow tent. Dean borrows objects from the audience, and Sam tells him what they are, blindfolded and facing backwards. They raise up spirits who shake the little stage and tell secrets no one could possibly know. Sam floats chairs with his mind and picks a blooming rose out of a mirror. The kettle shrieks, and Sam hands Dean his mug. Dean balances it with one hand and shifts his legs and body into the one position that is 80% comfortable for the both of them in their tiny little nest of smashed cushions and dirty sheets. Sam drapes a quilt over himself and inches into position, head on chest, three knees interlocked, one cocked up, spare arms tucked away and under, feet either sticking out into the air or propped up against the cabinet that serves as a footboard. They don't say anything else about the knives or the murders, just take turns sipping at their chocolate. Dean knows Sam is asleep when his body starts putting off heat like a radiator and his breathing extends into long sighs. Dean puts his mugs away, tries to close his eyes, but his heart keeps jumping like he's waiting for something long expected, and he feels self-conscious under the black sky outside the little window. Three families. He can picture each one. Each parent's body, torn apart and half-eaten with blood on the bedsheets, and each horrified, dead child waiting standing, responsible in the carnage. In his mind's eye, the child is always a six-year-old boy with sandy hair and hazel eyes and a sleeping toddler in his arms. The face of the clown, under all the makeup and the wig and the hideous painted smile, is perfectly recalled too. No surprise, considering he and Sammy see it every godforsaken day, faking blind and barking orders. Dean settles back into his cushion, Sam breathing warm into the hollow of his throat. North Platte won't be any better. But as long as Sammy stays, Dean will too. He learned long ago that it's not the where that matters, it's the who you're with.